thank you. So I don't have many slides prepared. I could have prepared hundreds of slides if I really wanted to, but my real aim is more to give you a sense of scale, which even people in computer science don't completely recognize, and I think people outside of it have no clue that the systems you deal with every day are really just of amazing complexity. And the fact that they work at all is, I don't know what. I mean, I don't necessarily want to appeal to a deity, but it's certainly a marvel. Well, I think probably the better way to put it is awesome, as in you should be in awe of it in both in its grandeur and its terribleness. But anyway, so just to give you an idea, so when you use Google, when you use Facebook, so estimate, I was doing some estimates last night, kind of going, you can't actually pin these numbers down because they are proprietary. But last estimates I was seeing, Google has around 2 million servers, 2 million computers in about 40 data centers around the globe. Facebook, I saw current estimates, has around 180,000 servers. So that's on one side. Then what's sitting in your pocket has hundreds of millions of transistors. Just what's in your pocket. And I mean, even let's think. How many of you have Kindles? Okay. So that little Kindle, it's an e-reader. I'm talking about the e-ink ones. I'm not even talking about like the Kindle Fire and stuff, which are tablets and can do all kinds of things. I'm talking the e-readers. The e-readers are full-fledged computers running tens of millions of lines of code. For an e-reader, a piece of paper. Now, to give you an idea, when I say millions of lines of code, how big is War and Peace? Any idea? How big is War and Peace?
700 pages.
Yeah, so like words. Any idea? It's around 100,000 words. That's, a really large novel is around 100,000 words. Modern programs are measured in the millions of lines of code. For example, I'll talk about this more, but so to get these kinds of systems, before I can start talking about anything, I have to talk about Moore's Law. Have any of you heard of Moore's Law? A few of you? So Moore's Law comes from this guy, Gordon Moore, one of the co-founders of Intel. Probably have heard of that little company, right? Intel. He made an observation in the 60s that the number of transistors that could fit on a chip was doubling every 18 months. And he said that this is going to continue. And it has. For the past 50 years, that is what gets you a billion transistors on a chip, which is what a modern desktop microprocessor has, is order a billion transistors. If you get a really nice model, you can go up to 2 billion transistors. If it's a more budget model, you might be in the half a billion, 750 million. Order a billion transistors in one chip. So this is showing, this graph is showing Moore's Law. This is a log scale. So you see log linear plot. So as you go on time, you see down here is the 8080, the 80486. Here you go to the Pentium, the AMD, and now we're getting into our Itaniums and power chips and AMD and Intel Core i7s are up here. Doubling the number of transistors on a chip every 18 months. And Moore's Law, some people, you may wonder, well, is this just a law of nature? Or is this some sort of another thing? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The entire semiconductor industry is organized around Moore's Law. They plan out the next 5-10 years, saying, okay, we're going to double the number of transistors here. We're going to double the number of transistors here. and they say, what technology do we need to double the number of transistors? Oh, we're going to have to use X-rays in order to write the transistors onto the chips. Well, we better develop a way to focus X-rays. Or, you know, we need to find a way to make something that can react to ultraviolet light. I mean, the things they're doing to generate chips is insane. A modern chip fab is a industrial behemoth that costs billions of dollars to build. There are not many companies that make real chip fabs. Anyone know what the companies are? The big ones?
Foxconn.
Nope. Foxconn is not a major chip producer. Foxconn is a major computer producer. The big chip producers, Samsung makes chips. TSMC in Taiwan, they make chips for everyone. You give them the design you want, they build it. Intel and IBM still has their own chip foundries. There are some smaller ones, but those are the big players. And in fact, of those, Intel is the best. They are so much the best. They are an entire process node better than everyone else in the industry. They're going for 22 nanometer scale features, and the rest of the industry is working on 32 nanometer features.
Dinosaurs.
I mean, it's kind of crazy when you look at this stuff. You know what the scales are, but Intel does not have the best design. In terms of practicality, in terms of elegance from an engineering perspective, other people have designed chips that are potentially more advanced in some ways, certainly using instruction sets that are more advanced. But Intel has been able to build chips in combination with their processes so that they're ahead of everyone else. They can take technology that arguably should have died 30 years ago and keep making it faster and faster and faster than anyone else. There's an entire story of how chips have become incredibly complex. Now, what does it mean when you have that many transistors? What do you do with those transistors? I mean, how do you build something out? I mean, we used to build microprocessors out of tens of thousands of microprocessors of transistors. Now you give me a billion. What do I do with them? Turns out this isn't just a challenge for you in this room. This is a challenge to the chip designers. Every time they double the number of transistors on a chip, they go around saying, how do we use those transistors usefully? Yes? So what are the next... So any idea how Intel and other companies have dealt with this? Having more and more transistors? What do they put on these things?
More graphics.
Graphics is one thing. Well, have you looked inside a modern computer, like a desktop? And if you look compared to a computer, say, I don't know if they used to, like Apple IIs. If you go back a couple of decades, you looked inside a computer and you saw lots and lots and lots of little chips. Like, a dozen, maybe, 50 or more or something. Big machines have lots and lots of chips. How many chips do you see inside a desktop? Not many. And if you look inside your iPhone and you see how many chips are inside your iPhone, not many. I mean, we're talking like the number you can fit on your hand. And mainly it's one chip. So what happens is everything that can go inside a computer goes on the chip. Originally it was I/O functions, then there was like a math coprocessor that went on, and then memory management went on, and then video now is going on it. They just kept throwing things onto these chips. But they ran into a problem. They couldn't make the processors any faster as single chips. So they did something funny. You know how your computer now, you go out and buy a computer, it says how many cores there are? That's because they used to be able to say, I'll just throw those transistors and make one processor faster. So the processor is the basic unit that does computation inside a computer. And they kept doing this, and they kept saying, using all these tricks, and they got, I can't make it any faster. I throw more transistors at it, it doesn't go any faster. So what'd they do? Make more of them and stick them all on the same chip. That's why latest smartphones have four cores. They're quad-core processors. That means they effectively have four entire microprocessors on them. Four very sophisticated microprocessors on them in your pocket. Graphics, GPUs, graphics processing units are actually very, very powerful supercomputers designed to, which actually have hundreds to thousands of little computational units to do graphics. They have a special design because what it is you have an image, you say, I want to transform this image. So they divide up that image into, say, 2,000 pieces, and they want to do the same transform on all 2,000 pieces. They give one instruction, say, do it all this thing to those 2,000 pieces, 2,000 units go at it, and do it in parallel, do it at once. In the past, those things that would do the operations were very primitive. They could only do certain operations. They were fixed function units. Nowadays, they're full-fledged little computers. They can do anything the main processor can do. They're optimized for streaming through large images and large sound files and other things. But they can do anything. So just in my pocket are multiple full processors and this graphics processing unit that has hundreds of little processors designed for graphics. That's my pocket. So one consequence, as I've talked about all this, but I haven't talked about this. One advantage of making transistors smaller and smaller and smaller is they take fewer electrons. They take less power. If you can get them to work, they'll do the same work for less. This is why we have portable electronics. It's not just that there's so many transistors that can fit in a chip. That chip now takes much, much less power. That's why you're, because in fact, battery technology hasn't really been improving. And in fact, if you were to really improve battery technology in anything close to the way other technologies have in the computer industry, you'd have bombs in your pocket, eventually nuclear bombs. And because the energy density we're talking about, there are already lithium ion batteries are very dense in power. If you started doubling that every 18 months, so it's a good thing that the power has gone down. But now, okay, so we've got these giant chips that are everywhere. What do you run on them? So a funny thing about your computer you might have noticed is, does your computer get faster? Double in speed every 18 months? Do you feel that when you surf the web and you do other things, you play your games? Does it feel twice as fast? No. So the software guys have been running around and going, oh, it's a more powerful computer. I can make it do more stuff. And so as a result, the programs get bigger and bigger and bigger. So that now, a decade ago, if I had, several megabytes of RAM in my computer, I'd be very happy. Now, if I have 1 gigabyte of RAM, if I have 1,024 megabytes of RAM, it's too small. I need at least 4 gigabytes of RAM, otherwise I'm not happy in my desktop. My phone should have, at least 512 megs or a gigabyte itself. So, I'm a software person, and so I will admit we're little piggies. We just give us more resources, we'll just make bigger and bigger programs. And it's gotten a little out of control because modern programs are millions of lines of code. And they aren't just millions of lines of code. They're millions of lines of code that depend on other million line programs. So for example, the core of your computer, the base code that runs your computer is typically called an operating system kernel. It's the thing that turns the computer that you have into the computer that programmers want to program. It's not the computer you want to use. That requires another couple of layers. But that's the base layer of abstracting away the differences in the hardware into something more uniform. Because hardware varies enormously, but programmers don't want to deal with that mess. So the operating system kernel is the one that deals with that mess and also manages the resources of the system. If you don't have a kernel running the system, you can't really do much else. So one popular kernel is Linux. So when people talk about Linux systems, they're just talking about the Linux kernel. There's a whole bunch of other software that goes on top of it, but that's the core that defines a Linux system. How much code is in the Linux kernel? You know, latest releases I hear now are about up to about 15 million lines of code in the Linux kernel. That's the base level. Now, on top of this, you'll run, you know, you have to run something to do graphics, you'll have to run something to manage your sound, you'll have to run something, some sort of library and stuff. And then maybe, hey, you'd want to do something like surf the web. Right? So, let's say I run something like Firefox or Chrome. How many lines of code are in those things? About 5 million lines of code. On top of this 15 million line of code behemoth, and with other million lines of code in this library or something like that. I mean, it's just big chunks of code. Now, as a programmer, let's say I find a bug. What do I do? I can't even read all the code that's on there. I don't even know all the code that's on there. Where do I start? So the way programmers have managed this is through this concept of abstraction. What we do is we basically make black boxes. We say, oh, there's all this mess and stuff, but don't pay attention to that. Close up the box, and all that's going to come out of it are these little, you know, interfaces, a couple little connections. Just pay attention to that. And then take that box, connect it to this box. Now I have 1,000 of those boxes all connected together. Let me put a box around that. That's now one big box. Don't pay attention to what's going inside. Now I got those. Now I take 1,000 of those boxes. Oh, well, let's put another box around those. That's what modern software is. It's boxes inside boxes inside boxes, all connected together in all kinds of crazy ways. So what you do in order to find a problem is you hopefully can start subdividing. You say, okay, well, is it in this giant box or is it in this giant box? And then, okay, once I get it's over in this box now, let me try splitting it apart. And let me try splitting those boxes apart. Sound difficult? And this is why you'll notice probably your systems that you run today are a little bit flakier than they used to be. And they're flakier because, I mean, we can find the common bugs. But when you're talking about systems with that much code, you're going to have interactions between them that no one has tested. It's just simple combinatorics. So what do you do? Do you say, I'm going to sit there and try to find every bug? No. You say, won't fix. It's not a big one. It doesn't cause data loss. It doesn't cause the system to crash most of the time. So we'll just move on. So then, this isn't the worst of it. Now we're getting to data centers. So these are some pictures from Google data centers. Remember I said they've got like 2 million machines? How do you organize 2 million machines? What do you do with them? Well, your unit of computation is not a PC. It's a container. As in a shipping container, you know those things they stick on the back of semis? That's what those are. That's how they now build data centers. They make those giant computers. Basically, well, not giant, well, they are. They just have lots of smaller computers inside them. They have racks and racks of computers inside a container. And then you get a building where you just stack up these containers. Hundreds of these things. So, thinking about this, you should have a couple of things that come to mind. That's a lot of computers. That's a lot of power. How much electricity is that running? So do you know where these data centers get located? Any idea where these companies look for very specific kinds of places. What do you think you want out of a place with for a data center?
Cheap electricity. Hmm?
Cheap electricity. Reliable electricity.
You don't want to be in a seismic zone. So in other words, you don't want things to be shaken.
Yeah, yeah. Seismic stability. Yeah, hopefully not too many storms and stuff, you know.
Cold weather.
What? Good weather?
Cold weather.
Oh, yeah. Cold weather. Yeah, that helps with the cooling. You know, Iceland's potentially good for some of this, not some other parts. Canada should actually be potentially very good for locating data centers, although I haven't really heard much about data centers being built in Canada. They more are in parts of the U.S. Yes?
But the amount of electricity available, that must be the upper limit, the upper constraint that determines how big a data center can ultimately be.
It's not electricity, actually, because one of the big trends in building these data centers is how power efficient they are. Because, in fact, it's not the electricity per se, but it's the heat generated by the computers. They aren't concerned with getting the fastest chips, but they want the fastest chip per watt. You know, say MIPS per watt. Because the more watts you burn, the more heat you generate. And dispersing of the heat, when you're talking this kind of density, is not easy. I mean, you have to really engineer it. So that's why cold weather is potentially useful. But I mean, they need a lot of electricity. But they've actually been... Yes? You do potentially want to worry about someone breaking into your systems. But of course, the physical assault on a data center... So let's say I want to steal someone's data. Okay. It's in the Google Cloud. Where is it? How do I find it? Which of the 2 million machines do I steal? You know, you can do a physical assault on it, but at most what you might want to do is stick something in there to tap what's on there and then do some sort of software-based attack, because a lot of these attacks are much easier if you're physically on the inside of the network as opposed to on the outside. But, so, I mean, these guys all, what's really funny, I find, about if you look at these data centers, they'll go on about how sophisticated their security is. We take handprints before you can get into the center. We have these giant blast doors. We have all this stuff. It's like, okay, sure. But what about, you know, the guys, you know, sitting half a world away who figures out my password, types it in, and starts, you know, deleting my data? So, physical security, they always talk about physical security. I don't care about the physical security, honestly, of these things. I mean, except for, I really don't want them to blow them up. But honestly, Google, you blow up one of their data centers, nobody notices. Because it's all so redundant and distributed. I mean, when you're out talking at the scale they're talking about, you can't fix individual computers. They have many more computers than they have humans. And all these data centers are often random locations. They're not right in Mountain View where their engineers can go and, you know, fix their machines. So what do they do when a machine breaks? They ignore it. They just may power it off remotely. They just have the software just works around it. And during maintenance, periodically, they'll go through and find all the servers that have gone bad and replace them. You don't provision these things individually. What they literally do is they'll drive a container up to this place saying, oh, we want to expand. Here's another container. Plug it in. It's up. It auto-configures. Their software just automatically integrates it in with the network. Think of the Borg.
Yeah.
I mean, just sort of automatically going out there and reconfiguring. That's what this software is like. It's designed to run on hardware that is not trustworthy. That hardware that will fail. Because in the course of a web search, a hard drive somewhere probably died. The hardware's dying all the time. It's not like they buy really nice machines for this. At the scale of these guys are doing, they can't afford it. They're buying the same PCs, basically the same spec stuff as you buy in Best Buy. They just buy a lot more of it. So it's failing all the time. And the software deals with it. But their software is complex enough to recognize these faults and repair itself automatically. Google is a hardware company. The things they produce are data centers. That's what they manufacture, is data centers and the software to run on them. They won't sell them to anyone else. They rent them out. Of course, the rent's kind of funny way to be paid. You are not a customer to these companies. You're the product. And that's the thing to realize with things like Facebook and Google, is this infrastructure costs billions of dollars to maintain and expand. Where are they getting that money? They're not getting it from us. They're getting it from advertisers. That's how much our information is worth. It's enough to build that. And if that doesn't scare you about privacy, I don't know what does. And that shows you the value. So chips are big. Programs are huge. And there's a lot of computers out there. Now I can tell you a story about what this means for security, for all kinds of other things, but you should just be hopefully just thinking about what kind of world do we live in? And I don't understand it. And I teach people how to build these things. Anyway, thank you.